Welcome to the World of Wisdom podcast. My name is Amit Paul, and today it'll be fun. We will. I think I just figured out that I met a next generation cyberneticist, maybe, or the evolution of them, and that had me sort of a little bit. It got me goosebumps because I've only read them before, and it makes me excited. I think we might talk about future today. I think we might talk about transition. And maybe we'll talk a little bit about transformation too. Who knows? But very welcome to the podcast, Elina Eriksson.
Thank you. I'm very happy to be here.
Should there have been like a title? Should I have said Dr. Elina Eriksson or something?
No,
like
I don't think that's not super important to me. And usually people forget what it is. But I'm an associate professor in human-computer interaction with a specialization in sustainability. So it's a fairly long title.
That's good. I would have twisted my tongue. I will, however, start you off with, for sure, the most difficult question we will deal with today, which I always start with, which is, who are you, Elina Eriksson?
Oh, that's a good question. Fortunately, I'm quite well prepared for that one. So I started teaching again. And when I teach, I usually do a Petra Kucha presentation of myself. So that's a presentation format where you have, for example, 9 slides in a PowerPoint, and then you have 25 seconds per picture to present yourself. So I have a couple of slides in my mind when you ask me like that. So I'm an associate professor at the Royal Institute of Technology in Stockholm, Sweden, abbreviation KTH. I'm a mother of 2, so I have 2 teenage children. That's always interesting. And I'm a half Finn. So my mother came from Finland and half of my family's living in Finland, although I'm not a fluent Finnish speaker. So I train on Duolingo currently. I am a farmer's daughter. So I grew up in the countryside on a farm. I'm the first in my Swedish half of the family, at least, with a doctoral degree. What else should I say? I love to be outdoors, to ski or sail or trek or things like that. But it has been a little bit of a, like when you have small children, you maybe don't do it as much as you did before you had children. And now when the kids are getting bigger, you're starting to do it again and you're like excited and it's really nice. But your body has grown old, so it's also more painful.
I can relate to the last part, but my kids are still pretty small, so we're still in the "we'll do that later" phase. And I mean, one of the main topics, the conventional way of talking about it, would be something like sustainability, right? That you're thinking and looking at and teaching and so forth, but. You've also taken that, I think, a few steps further or beyond. At least that would be how I would say it. You don't seem to hold a very conventional frame when we were talking in terms of the prep for this interview. So I'm curious if you would kind of lead us into both the way that you see and think about the world right now, but also maybe through like how you got here or why you care. Kind of.
Yeah. Well, I mean, so growing up on a farm, nature is always around you, and I spent more time with nature than I did with friends when I was a kid. And I remember my father, maybe some 25 years ago, coming to me saying, like, I'm thinking about becoming an organic farmer. Would you be ashamed of me or you know, if I'd become that? And I was like, no, of course not. And it was important. I mean, the organic farming became very important to us. And, you know, I sorted my waste and did all the things that a good Swede do. And then I had my first child. She was born in 2008. And I have this distinct memory of breastfeeding her at a friend's place. And he's one of the most down-to-earth persons I know. I got to know him through studying at the university. He was a couple of years older than me, and he had broken his leg, so he needed someone to help him to get a package from the post office. And I was sitting there, I'd been able to manage to get both the baby and the package up into his apartment, and I was breastfeeding her, and he was saying very calmly, like, so I bought land because that's the only thing that will be worth anything in the future. And for me, that kind of, I remember, like, but I can't buy my apartment. How am I supposed to be able to buy land? And then he introduced me to the topic of peak oil. And it wasn't as if I hadn't heard about it, but I think it became much more concrete and real that this future might not hold the same promises as I've been taught when I grew up. And I guess that since 2008, it has been a process and a journey to figure out what's wrong with the world and how to both redirect my own life, but also in terms of my work, change it so it feels meaningful. So I wanted to be able to contribute, to be able to see my kids in the eyes when they grow up and say that I did as much as I could. And I guess that I also have grown in my knowledge of the state of the world together with the world. So in some things I think we didn't know 15 years ago, and some things we did know. So maybe that's some of the journey here. And then, it's hard to know what is the key things that happens in your life. But I also have had a part of my life that was fairly difficult in my private side. So, I was already a PhD student when I got this revelation in 2008, and I did my dissertation on public authorities and how they handle their internal development of systems for their civil servants. So we were focusing on how can we make them more user-centered, this process. And then later, after my dissertation, when I became a PhD, I started focusing on sustainability issues. And I had the opportunity, which I'm very happy about. So I've been able to build a research group here at KTH together with a colleague. And I guess that has been a little bit of a lifesaver in the sense that it's been giving me meaning. And it's also a context where I've been able to grapple with the very hard questions that come up when you go deep into the state of the earth. Mm. So that's have been a lifeline, basically. And then on my kind of private side, my mother passed away in cancer in 2014. And in 2015, my then husband got a cancer diagnosis as well. I went through treatment and I had small kids, etc. So I think it's kind of hard. Like, you might wonder, why am I bringing this up? But it's really hard to separate my private life from my working life, because they're kind of intertwined. And I'm not sure I would be the same person today as if I hadn't gone through these things. So I know that when we talked about this podcast before, we were talking about inner transition. And this is one of the things that I maybe prepared me more to work with inner transition. So that's about it. And then you asked me where I am or kind of my view on life or
the world,
or what we're doing.
What did you learn from studying what's wrong with the world?
Yeah, exactly. when I started focusing on sustainability issues, in the beginning it was very much sustainable lifestyles and how can we help people with a better app to make better choices when they go to the shop and things like that. And then as I progressed and when I kind of met the work of Donella Meadows and her leverage points, I started to think about, like, maybe it's something much deeper that needs to be changed. And then and that is like the paradigm or the worldview or our way of being in the world. And that's deep things and kind of hard to understand how we're going to change that, because it's something that we all carry together with all the infrastructure and technology and all the laws and all the culture and everything. So it feels like it's impossible to change. And then paradoxically, you come back to the individual. So if I, in the beginning of my sustainability studies, we're looking at how can we help individuals to make better choices. I've come a full turn, and I'm like, well, it is something that can only happen in people. And then we have to communicate and share that with each other and explore this. But in earnest, it is an inner transition that is needed in order to be able to wholeheartedly go into a new world or work with transition and transformation.
Do you make a distinction between transition and transformation?
I think I a bit sloppily use them both. But I guess that when you talk about the transformation, it's not only that you shift from one state to another, but it's more fundamental or more like might feel much more.
Yeah, sort of rearrangement.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that is it's like one of those things that's been important to me. It's like that both seems to be happening to me. Like we're both transitioning and transforming, and like they depend on each other and. They have a lot to do with one another, but it's not the same thing. But I'm curious about that because, I mean, apart from... what's the question here? I mean, a lot of your work is also systemic. And so I'm wondering if, like, from where you're looking, like, what falls in the individual bucket? Like, how does the systemic and the individual communicate or exchange?
I'm not entirely sure about that. I mean, I am kind of humbly struggling with this. Basically, I think that often when I meet a lot of students and they want to have kind of simple and clear-cut answers, and often they want to know, like, well, is it us that need to change, or is it a political thing and the state should change, or is it the companies that should change? And and I'm like, it's all of the above. Like, we have to work on all of these levels, and they're communicating with each other. So if we change a law. Like ecocide law that I know that has been a topic on this podcast. So if we change ecocide or we introduce ecocide as a law in the criminal court, International Criminal Court in Den Haag, then that is like a change in the system, the technical system or the system. But it's also something that changes or could change how we view things, which is something very like personal. But then in aggregation, that is something that then becomes culture or norms in society. And these things have to change at the same time because within my own research field, a lot of focus have been on nudging or persuasive technologies or something just to help people make better choices and also then not tell them what to do, but encourage them to go in a certain direction. And it's kind of naive since a majority of the messages that people are receiving every day is messages of buy more and spend more on this and that. You should have a beautiful body and you should have a good, like huge car and then you'll be happy and so on. And then you have like one app that is supposed to tell you how much carbon footprint tomatoes have. And it's like, that doesn't really add up. It is on all levels at the same time. And while we want organizations or municipalities and regions and states and global organizations to change, they are also comprised of people. So that is one way of kind of making change is to make sure that it propagates in larger and larger circles or like mycelium.
And I mean, if you would be speaking to your students, and I guess, are they then, they are like between 20 and maybe 30 or 25 or like that. No. So they're born like early 2000, basically. Crazy. Okay. And I'm going to go down that and like, stop, pause that thought. How do they come into the subject? Like what pulls them or like what's pushing them into the
well, here's the thing. They don't have a choice. So I'm teaching mainly the media technology students, the media technology engineers here at KTH. We have a 5-year engineering program. And in their third year, they have to take a mandatory sustainability course, which a colleague of mine is the course leader of. And we've developed the course together, and we've been teaching it for the last a little bit more than 10 years. And many of these students, they didn't choose this because they're interested in the environment or sustainability or anything. And I will say that their kind of their background or how much they know about sustainability have changed during these 10 years. So they're much more knowledgeable now. They're much more, especially the last 2 years, I'd say that they are much more prone to understand systemic thinking directly. So it seems as if they quite easily start understanding system thinking concepts. They're also more worried. They're more feeling anxiety or feeling that the future isn't so bright. So that's a change. But they didn't choose this particular course. It's a mandatory course. And in different parts of KTH, we solved it in different ways, how to give them this course. And in our particular course, because of me and Daniel, and we're people who read a lot, they get to read a lot.
Mm.
So they get to read about the planetary boundaries, the research papers. They get to read the Living Planet Report by World Wildlife Foundation, and they get to look into resource depletion, and they get to look into oil and energy and social sustainability and all of these different things. And they, first of all, a majority of them become really, really engaged.
Mm.
And then some of them have some kind of profound experience where they might even start questioning their choice of education. We don't do any hocus pocus. We just let them spend time reading all these facts. And then we have seminars where we ask them to post the questions to the seminar and we discuss them in circle practice. And so they become really engaged. And then now I'm teaching a continuation course called Sustainable ICT in Practice. And I have a very small group of students. So there are 12 of them. It's a master level course. And they have chosen this course. So the ones that come to me are now very engaged. But they have not studied so much environmental issues or sustainability otherwise than this. So this is like their chance to deepen their knowledge. And they're quite keen on understanding how they're going to go out into industry and work with this and what kind of change they can make. And some of them are asking for hope, wanting to get a more positive picture of what's possible.
And because that's what I was like, oh, they become engaged. I was like, ah, I would have thought that they would become depressed or like it's been like flattened by the sort of gravity of the situation, especially like the type of stuff that you would have them read. But they become engaged. So I'm wondering like why or
how? Yeah, and I think that so 2 years ago, I think about 2 years ago, we had a project where we looked into eco anxiety. I mean, we've noticed that they get emotional reactions to the course material, and we've been thinking what we can do about that. And then we got some money to spend some hours to think about it. And we read up on eco anxiety, and there's a good paper by a Finnish researcher, Kupano Pihkala, and he's written to educators and giving them recommendations on how to handle eco anxiety in students. So we evaluated our course and like went through and looked at what are we doing in the course. And we did quite a lot of good things. So for example, having these seminars that we have in the course, we asked the students, all of the students, to send in a question before the seminar. And then Daniel, my colleague, he collates them. So we have 110 students and that's too many questions. So he goes through them each week and picks out 30 of them and prints them on paper. We bring them to the seminar. In the seminar, we sit in a circle and we do a check-in, and then we ask them how they're feeling in general, and then they get to vote on what questions they would like to discuss in that particular classroom. And then we discuss them in pairs and then in the big group. And we kind of create this space where you feel that you're being listened to and that the questions that you pose are important and it's their own questions. And if people want to discuss, for example, emotional reactions or whatnot, that's a possibility. Mm. And we did some other things. So I think that they might feel hopelessness, but they don't feel anxiety as much as if they had taken another course where you didn't really acknowledge that this is a situation where we're at a breakdown or a breakthrough. So they draw those conclusions themselves, like this could go either way. We could maybe fix this, but we could also end up in a situation where we have a runaway climate crisis, and then what are we going to do? And I think that it's important to then just not give them facts, but also acknowledging that this is difficult. So a few other things. We have started to tell them that we as teachers also have emotional responses to this material. We have been telling them what are good things to do if you feel anxiety. So first and foremost, if it's a little anxiety, you should talk to your peers in the course. So kind of verbalize whatever you're feeling when you're reading the material. To engage somehow with maybe student, there are lots of student organizations at KTH who work with sustainability, so they could engage with student organizations, or there are organizations outside of KTH that we not recommend, but we kind of tell them that these are some of the organizations you could look into. And then we tell them that if you have a response that affects your everyday life negatively, you feel so much anxiety, and it doesn't matter what. Like it could be because you have so many deadlines, or you have an emotional response to the material or whatnot. But if you have anxiety that affects your everyday life, you should contact a professional. And you should contact, they have like student health here with psychologists that they can talk to. And then telling them that it's pretty important if it is connected to climate change or environmental issues that you find a therapist that also takes this seriously. Because if you meet the therapist that try to downplay the situation, it could actually be worse.
And so, what comes to mind, so I'm just kind of trusting the impulse here, and let's see if it derails us. But it's what comes to mind is this sort of this view of culture as the water that we swim in. So it's like the stuff that we don't see, or like, I mean, that's one way to see it. And I would, another image that I've been, that feels relevant right now would be like the it's almost like one of those cones that dogs have and so it like only allows you to look in a certain direction, and it only allows you to do certain things and scratch yourself in certain ways and stuff like that. It's almost like it's like that, it's like this restraining thing, but we don't see the cone. We just like, oh, the world got smaller or something like that. And then when I see it with my kids, I mean, they're 6 and 8, so they're young, but a lot of the stuff, we went to a food court, and there were that was in the fishing quarter here in Reykjavik, and they were showing a boat that was fishing, and like the amount of fish that they pull out in the net, and like there were men like shoveling fish and so forth. And then my youngest was like, "Are those fish? Are they alive? What are they doing?" Like, there's just these questions that are like, they're so natural, but, and then you're as a parent, you start answering like, yeah, that's just how it's done. And then I'm like, wait a minute. But like this dissonance between, that's what I heard you kind of describe as well, that you have, because you don't create that dissonance, because like the way that they see the world is kind of validated. And then you can be with that together for a while. Mm. Maybe that relieves perhaps some of the pressure and there. Yeah.
Yeah, I think so. And I think it's important. And the thing is, there's nobody who has an answer currently. Nobody has an answer to this whole predicament, this meta crisis. So we all have to contribute. And the only way to I think do that is to acknowledge that we don't have a full answer. We might have ideas or directions or things that we think are more important than others, and we can support each other in exploring those. But nobody nobody has an answer. Like we can't turn to anyone. And that is really weird doing at a technical university, because we're supposed to give them the answers, because that is like the engineering education. Engineering education is to teach these students how to solve problems. And all of a sudden we're sitting here with a predicament that is unsolvable. And we're like, yeah, by the way, you won't be able to solve this. And especially not with an app that you have programmed, even though that would have been really neat, because that's what you can do. It is a bit scary to dismantle your teacher armor in that sense, and go into the room and say that I am afraid, I have anxiety, I feel that this is difficult, I don't have the full answers, and let's see what we can do with this. But I think that they appreciate it.
But I mean, you're basically shifting the whole premise for education, right? I mean, if we look at sort of the Prussian education,
yeah,
forming, like shaping people into something predetermined type, like that project of like making efficient cogs, you're inviting them to learn or something like that.
Yeah, and I think that this is something that has grown in us over the years, and we've changed. So it's not as if we've always been doing it like this, and it's not a shift that happened overnight. So it's kind of starting to be difficult for me to see when it started to shift. And I don't think that we're fully there yet in how we do this. But I think that what we're exploring here are teachings that is needed in a new paradigm. So if we need a paradigm shift, everything have to change, including education, or perhaps even like especially education. And to do that shift, we as teachers also have to change. So it's hard to teach with the methodology or the activities or teaching methods in the new paradigm from the old one, or being stuck in the old one. So it's also something that then turns the looking glass back at us, so that we also have to think about ourselves and what we do in a different way, which is fascinating, but also a bit scary. Yeah.
There's a nice symmetry there in a way. Like, it's like the world is scary, and then like the activities that we undertake in a way, like there's a, Nora Bateson would say that there's beginning. To me, it sounds like a beginning of a matching type thing. Like there's a certain symmetry between these different, like it becomes more fractal in nature. Like, and so we get to practice whatever it is we're preaching, like throughout. And unless we practice, if we step away from that, then we're probably not relevant. And then we're probably like, and that has a lot of different effects. But I mean, you could also argue that, like, when I went to Stockholm School of Economics, which wasn't that long ago, I'm not prone to anxiety like that, but I don't think the institution would have seen it as their role to care about the students' anxiety. Maybe I was like riding the shift over that happened, but it feels like even that is actually new and feels very refreshing when you talk about it.
Yeah, and the thing is, I think that I wouldn't dare to say that KTH as an institution cares, because I'm not sure that it has spread that much. But I have two things to say. First one was that some of this started during the pandemic, when our head of division told us that you have to look after the students a bit, because they might be very alone when they're isolated and so on. So please check in with them and say, ask them how they are, especially like master thesis students who are just working on their own and never do any classes. So we had then these seminars in much smaller groups online through Zoom. And one of my PhD students was a teaching assistant. So she started the round and she was like, hey, how are you? And there was a guy in her classroom. He just went silent. And then he said, you know what? I've been studying here at KTH for 5 years and nobody has ever asked me how I am.
Wow.
And I was like, oh my God, that's so dehumanizing that you never get to be like a full human being in relation to the teachers. Like you're just a little you know, piece of something in a board game and without a face or and so on. So that was one thing. And the other thing is that I don't like, I think that there's a starting to become a like an interest from both students, but also a lot of teachers to include more of us as humans in teaching, so that we are not only the brain and the rational thought, but including more bodily experiences and other types of teaching methods and so on. And I think that we're in the very beginning of that. But it's also hard to do it within like a system that we have today that has been here for hundreds of years, and especially for the last, I don't know, probably historian would know, 40 years or something, where student has become more and more customers, and also we get evaluated more and more on budgets, etc. So it's important that the students go through the system in the right way so that they get an exam, so that we get money on our account. And I mean, the old version of university was a place for learning, and it didn't, like, we didn't really care what kind of degree you took, because it was the learning that was in the center. But now it's like important that you end up being this particular type of engineer, because then we can be evaluated by the UKÄ, the, I don't know what that's called in English. Anyway, the governmental body that evaluates universities. And then it's like, we've lost something here, because there might be something fantastic in you choosing the wrong course, because you might learn something that helps you with the rest of your life, or shows you something that you would never have imagined, or you may meet people that will change you forever, or, you know, it's like, but now it's like, you should follow this little stream to this little end, so we know exactly what you become.
Yeah, it's like the Steve Jobs version of his, like, that speech that he did at some point. And he's like, oh, I took calligraphy, and that's why I could make fonts. And I did that, and I just followed my curiosity. It's a completely different thing. And I kind of want to switch gears a little bit, and let's see if we will kind of find our way back and close the loop. But I'm curious about, because the other topic that I dropped in the beginning that we talked about last time was the future. And as you said now, like that there are no answers right now. And at the same time, like I had a friend of mine, and we're exploring certain things that are quite woo, doesn't matter. But one of the things that we were digging into was the etymology of the word question, and that it relates to quest, and it relates to inquiry, and it relates to like things like conquest and inquest, and like there's a bunch of stuff that like question relates to, and I got very excited about that. But so if there aren't any answers about the future, and we can't know anything about the future, then we know kind of, we both have an assumption that the future that we're seeing is not going to be more of the same. Or less of, like, it's going to be something different. So how do we do that? Or like, why? What? Yeah.
Yeah. And I was invited as a guest lecturer in Uppsala at CMUS in the autumn. And they said, like, we want to have someone to talk about participatory futures. And I'm like, wow, that's a really cool name. That's what I'm doing. I didn't know that. so I have to look up if that is a substantial field, research field or not, and read up on it. But I think it's important to democratize futures, and also to help everyone, including ourselves, to be better at imagining futures, to explore different possible futures. Because it's easy to get stuck in either it will be more of the same, like business as usual scenarios, or to just see some kind of catastrophic situation where we have Mad Max or whatnot. And I think that's not very conducive, or how do you say, it's not very, doesn't help you much if those are the only two futures you could imagine. So there's a lot of people working on exploring futures for different reasons. It could be to warn people that we should act differently, or it could be to give a more clear picture of the different pathways that we could end up on if we don't follow the Paris Agreement. It could be to prepare people that it will be different. And personally, I have been, like many of my projects have been about exploring the future from an everyday perspective. So what would everyday life be like? Because many of the scenarios that you get from the Energy Agency or you know, the IPCC report or whatnot, those kind of models and quantified futures are really hard to understand. What would it be like for me? So what would the everyday practices be? How would I get my food? Where would I work? What would work look like? Et cetera, so then people fall back on like not thinking about it or thinking that we have to go back to some kind of caveman stage, like living on in the Stone Age, basically again. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that's the only options we have. So one of my very best research projects has ended last autumn, which I'm sad about. And there was a project where we collaborated with the Swedish Transition Movement. So the Transition Movement started in the UK. The founder is Rob Hopkins, and he's written a great book called From What Is to What If. Actually, by happenstance, had it here on my table. So they are interested. I mean, the transition movement is working both with a dual predicament of peak oil and climate mitigation / adaption. And it's a like a network of small movements going on all over Sweden. And we wrote a research application together where we said, could it be possible to use something called counterfactual scenarios or what we've later been calling past-casting to help people start discussing this in a local context. So they had a very specific practical problem. They wanted to have a tool that they could invite people who had never talked about transition before and start like exploring what could transition be. Mm. Here in this local community. And together with them, we then developed a workshop methodology that is now handed over to the Swedish Transition Movement. So it's available through their website, it's Creative Commons licensed. We've had like a train the trainers. So there's lots of people in Sweden now who knows how to use the material. And you can take it and run with it. And hopefully during the spring, we will also have an English translation of it. And what we do in that workshop is that we pose the what-if scenario, that what if the 2008 financial crisis wasn't a financial crisis, it was actually an oil crisis, and the whole world decided to transition to more renewable energy and etc. It took a couple of years before we really got going, but that made it so that we today live in a world where we only use half the oil. And then after having to think a little bit about what they're grateful for in the present, they go into this alternative present and discuss what would life here in this municipality look like if we only used half the oil. So everyday practices. Where do the food come from? Where do we work? How do we handle waste, etc.? And they get to talk to each other. And then afterwards, we cluster these practices that they describe. And then we, from these practices, they get to choose one theme. So usually it's transport, food, housing, mm-hmm. leisure, or something like that. So they get to then explore what would have needed to have happened between 2008 and now. For us to end up in an alternative present when we use only half the oil. So then you might ask like, oh, but is this really a futures method? Is this a method to explore the future? Well, thing is, it's something that we need to do in the future to cut our emissions by 50%, which is basically use half the oil. But by putting in the past, you have two things that help you. One is that we've already achieved it. Yay! So we don't have to... I mean, it's already done. We just mm-hmm. have to figure out the details. And the second thing is that you know who you are today. As you said, your kids were 8 and I don't remember.
Six.
What, six. Yeah. So you know what everyday looks like today. But if I asked you, what will everyday look like for you in 10 years' time when they're 18 and 16? You wouldn't be able to describe that in very much detail. So by transposing this shift that we need to do into the present, it kind of helps you to understand what everyday practices would look like, and you can imagine that easier. And then you can, you know, transpose that back and look like, okay, so forward-looking, what do we need to do now to start on this journey? And this is similar to a backcasting. So there's a methodology within future studies, and that's called backcasting, where you make a jump into the future, to a normative future that you want, and then you try to find the pathways to this normative future. So it's similar, but it's another way of playing with it. And I think both methods have merits. And ours are maybe more playful because we've created it together with the transition movement and their particular focus on opening up and planting seeds that they later can pick up and start working on.
I love that because it seems to invite, like you were saying, the celebration, which would invite some sort of relaxation. And we don't have to be so... I'm finding inappropriate language about things where the sun doesn't shine. Where there's not a lot of light. Like we don't need to have stuff there.
No.
We can kind of remove them and just. Mm. So that I think is exciting. And then, yeah, it also kind of gets to the question of like, what's the future anyways, or like, And then you're in, there's an invitation to like, what's also here? Like, that's such an interesting question. Like, what are we not seeing in this very moment? And I mean, I think we could discover a lot that's.
And what's been fascinating, because we've done it in 9 different places, or during the project, we did it 9 times, both online and in physical. And then we did a couple of train the trainers. And so maybe we did it 12 times or something like that. It's a 3-hour workshop. And only once did AI come into play. So technological solutions are not the things that you talk about when you transpose this like this. So it's more policy changes and more changes to practices. And I have had in one of the places we were at, there were a couple of late counselors, like people who couldn't come. And then the people who invited us there, they brought their mothers who hadn't thought about these things so much. And at the end of the workshop, one of the mothers were writing down at the very end, like what she wanted to do next. And she's like, I have realized during this workshop that I need to consume less. And I find that super interesting, because it's usually quite hard to come to the conclusion that I need to do less of something, that I have to abstain or you know. But she, for her, that became very clear when she had to hammer down what would life look like if I only use half the oil. And you can't like, you know, there's no quick fix or no technological solution in the future to help us, but rather we have to figure it out with whatever we had already, which is the most likely scenario that we're going to have future-wise also.
Yeah. And I mean, I'm just also thinking about, because I'm currently, my head is a lot sort of in the past. So I'm spending a lot of time emotionally and intellectually right now, like 25 years ago. And then, so I've been looking at like, what was there then? Like, there was no Facebook, no Instagram, like music was not online, and like, there was no Spotify. I mean, it's not like we haven't, even if we're now really focused on this whole AI arms race and whatever, however we frame that thing, and I'm sure it's going to be significant. I mean, there's been incredible developments over the past, even if we don't go as far as 20 years, but just, you know, 15 or something. And at the same time, like you're pointing out, like my life isn't that different as I use the tools, but a lot of my thinking and my habits and the way that I perceive the world or perceive the world to work is quite similar, you know. And of course, the technological environment influences how my girls see the world. Like they are, as you know, we stumbled across a record player, like a prop, like an old LP, like record player. And I was like, this is how we used to listen to music. And they're like, why? Why? You have it in your phone. Or like, you know, it's like, why do you need cash? You have a card. Like, what are you talking about? Stuff like that. That's fascinating. How this imagination thing, how can you do imagination well? Or like, how do we, okay, I'm going to ask the question like in a full, because so I had the experience over New Year's that as it was approaching New Year's Eve and I was following, I went to the bathroom and I looked at my social media flows. And then I saw people saying like, soon everything is going to be new. Like everything. It was as if the whole world said that in 3 minutes or in 20 hours or whatever it was like before, when the clock shifts and the new year is there, none of the old was going to matter. None of our old patterns and habits are going to matter. Now everything is going to be new. I'm going to be this new person with new goals and new. And I got like almost anxiety or like stress or like I was angry. I was like, why can't people just see also the things that continue? Like there's so many past dependencies and so many habits and so many stuff that you have to deal with to get to the new. That so it's like this conflict almost between the stuff that goes on and the stuff that stops going on, and like stuff that we change and the stuff that changes us. And like there, and so I'm wondering, like from that point of view, when we do imagination, and you were saying like it can't just be more of the same or more of, how do you actually open up for something new to enter, or like for a new possibility, or to dig where you are? I mean, you described one methodology, but have you thought about like what the principles are of that?
Probably you should have another podcast guest who could help you even more with this. No, that's okay. But I mean, I can give my 5 cents, but they are not. This is why, like, when you have researchers, we're so. You know, we want to have everything backed up by lots of research. So, but I'll just give my personal 5 cents on this. So first of all, I think you need scaffolding. So often if you ask someone, could you tell a funny story, or could you like make show a fantasy story or something, people get stuck. So scaffolding is really good. You could have prompt cards, or you could have whatnot. But I think that we... And so Rob Hopkins, in his book, From What Is to What If, he states that we have a serious lack of imagination. And one problem is that the school system that we have is totally killing off our possibilities to be imaginative and have imaginary. And I think that's true. And I think, unfortunately, it's even more true with all the mobile phones and laptops and stuff that draws in our attention. And so this is a totally anecdotal thing, but The times when my kids grew up, I tried to not have so many playthings at home. And I mean, I didn't go like full-blown weirdo with them. They had, of course, playthings, but they probably, compared to other kids in their age, they didn't have as many things. And that meant that my kids had to make up stuff. So my daughter was really good at like coming with blocks of wood and about, oh, this is a plate, could you please eat from this plate? And the next time I came into the room, it was something else, like a car or something whatnot. And I think that there are studies that show that kids that play free play in the forest is much more imaginative than kids who have really detailed and fantastic and, you know, colorful and whatnot playthings. So it's as if, so this is contradictory then. It's like as if we get less things that distract us, we can become more imaginative. So that would like imply that maybe we should take away stuff and then just imagine. But I think since we are a little bit hampered by our educational systems and the culture that we're in, we need scaffolding. And I think that sometimes you kind of need to balancing. So we've been writing about this in some other products that we had, that we have to balance between the affirmative and the provocative. So maybe you need to enter something that makes you a little bit shaken or scared, or that makes it difficult for you, but also have things where you feel that you're being held in the hand somehow, or where you can get feel that you recognize yourself. And in this workshop, for example, lately, where we do the past casting scenario, we have things to prime them or to make them start thinking about everyday practices. And one is that we have these headline posters. And headline posters communicate things really quickly. So one would be the countdown, the last plane is taking off. Mm. And then people go like, what do they mean? Like forever? Or, and then they can start discuss like, no, I don't think it is that we will not have any planes. It's probably the charter planes that are being taken off the ground, or they may be closing this particular airstrip, or, you know, so they start discussing what this could mean. So that is a kind of scaffolding that I think is conducive. Let me think if I've had other examples of those kind of scaffolding things. Yeah, so in the workshop, we also have a very short day in life scenario for a person that they get to listen to, who has struggled going to the hardwood store, like the place where you buy wood and stuff.
Yeah, hardware store.
Yeah. So you have to coordinate with a neighbor because you don't go alone any longer with the car, and he wants to buy wood to making a terrace outside his house, and his daughter thinks it's a stupid idea because they could be growing things there instead. And, you know, and they get to hear like this everyday scenario where there's a little bit of sunshine but also a little bit of dissonance or friction. So that are like some of the ways I think it's good to tease out these things.
But yeah, thank you for your 5 cents. I'll take them. They spark a lot. I'm curious. What I get really curious about is like if we kind of weave these things together, like the stuff like when we talked about the students and how they approach this and get to spend time with this and come into relationship with the stuff and the material. And then like these techniques and scaffolds and like, you know, invitations to open up or like spark curiosity and like other ways of like approaching. But then I'm really curious, like from where you are sitting right now, like and with all of the like the knowledge that you bring into this, like what's the work right now? Like is there a thing or a few topics that you're like that's really sort of permeating or like keep showing up in the work? You know, they could be topical, but they could also just be methodological, I guess, or maybe stances, or like, you know, something you're trying to learn. I don't know exactly how to phrase the question, but yeah.
So one thing I think is super important currently, and I'm thinking quite a lot of how to do that, is to break silences and start talking about what's problematic in the world. Because I can see that even though we're good at bringing this forth to the student, because we have a somebody wants us to give a course on sustainability, so then we have like a green pass to do that, and we're allowed to talk about it. But how would I do this in my friend circle, and how would I do this in the association where I'm, you know, if I have an association that I'm active in, or at the gym or the football club or whatnot. And we're starting to come to a point where we can't wait any longer for someone else to speak up. We have to speak up, all of us, and start moving or acting in the right direction. So how do you break silences? I think that another movement is to do inner transition and inner work. And eco-anxiety and the things we do with the students, that's a kind of reactive way of handling it, just showing them that you might have emotional responses and how to do that. But the other side of it is that you need to do preparatory work so that you're able to handle those emotional responses when they come in the future or whatnot. And I think, like, this is not really my like I should become a psychologist or something. But I mean, I'm not entirely sure how I'm going to do that with my students, but I'm probably going to do it, even though it feels really weird to do it at the technical university, to start exploring what would that look like. Can we do it without having a degree in psychology? Because I think if we're afraid and scared and angry and frustrated, we're going to have less imaginary power and come up with less good solutions. And we will close down and become more afraid of what's different, etc. And that is not the direction that we need to go right now. I met this psychologist when I was in part of public radio, and I was in the studio together with another woman. She was a psychologist, and she said that her quest right now is to make mental health a topic within school. So a school topic. And she's like, said that for 100 years we've been having physical health as a topic in school. So why don't we have mental health as well? It's as if we kind of tell everybody that, okay, so we will teach you everything about how you train your body, etc., and you should know that fairly well. And then we teach you everything about knowledge and stuff like that, and how to cook and how to sew and how to make wooden spoons, etc. But becoming a human being, you have to figure out that out yourself without our help. And it's similar at the university. We don't really teach these students to become humans. We teach them to become a very thin sliver of a human who solves problems, and not really someone who interacts with other people, that holds space for each other, or that takes care of nature, or that has awe, or feel awe, or, you know, those kind of things. So I'm not sure. This feels like maybe the biggest thing to work on. Like, how can we be fully human in all that we do?
And I'm like, you told the story of the student that had never been asked how he was. Now this is just my projection, but to me, just to have the question to ask that, have the courage to ask that question, is, to me, that's already doing it.
Mm.
And it's great to bring mental health, also my projection, but like onto the schedule. But like, we have had physical health for 100 years. How well has it gone? Are we healthier? I don't think so. So I'm like, to me, like the mental, like it should more, like I'm looking to like the Greeks or something, where it's like, you can't think unless you have a fit body. You can't, like, so that should be all of it. Like everything should be, it shouldn't be a separate unit on a curriculum and that's problem solved. Let's move on. Now we're done. To me, it's just like, it should be there. Like, you're teaching the stuff, but you're teaching it in a way. That's why I'm so drawn to what you're describing and how you're working. It's like, because you're letting all of these areas that you don't have maybe full backup on, like, inform the stuff that you have perfect, like a lot of knowledge on, and like you can cite and reference and everything. And then you're reporting back that your experiments are working. So I'm like, I don't know. That's my armchair observation anyways, without any qualifications whatsoever.
So we have a new master's program. It's 2 years. It starts in the autumn. If you want to apply.
That's cool. Is there anything, but I love that. So to break silences, that's terrifying, right? And for at least to a Swedish person, it's terrifying. We don't even talk in the elevator. And then Finnish person, it must be even more.
Yeah.
I don't know. Yeah. And then inner work, was there something else?
No, on a personal level, through these years when I've had it a bit rough in my private life, I came to lots of practices that I later realized that they have names like mindfulness and stuff. And I just want to continue to focus on micro moments of happiness, like the smile on a stranger, or frost in the grass, or seeing the moon, the sliver of the moon in between clouds, and just savor that. Savor things, tiny, tiny, tiny things. And I wish I will be able to teach my kids that, because I think it's one of the most fundamental things that we should be doing all the time, to just be in awe of this world, because we need to love it so that we save it.
Mm. And you said happiness now, and I'm reading this. I'm reading the, I don't know, it's the Dalai Lama and Desmond Tutu, like that book about joy.
Mm.
And they made the distinction that joy is something that's like internal. It's like something that like, it's like when you remove everything, there's joy. Like it just kind of bubbles up through the pores of everything. And so it's like, yeah. Is there something else that we should talk about now as we're kind of starting to wrap up? Like, is there something that hasn't been said that would have served this conversation, or like something that I'm blind to, or?
No, first of all, it's a Friday afternoon when we do this conversation, and I've just started my course, and I've given lectures and presentations this week. So I'm starting to feel my brain being a bit slow. I don't know. I think that I will continue exploring inner transition. And I mean, we could have spent a full hour just on inner transition, but I think it's important to connect it to the futures and to inviting in everyone to discuss what the future could be like, and so that we can be engaged with the future. So I'm pretty happy with the balance here. We got to cover both of those. I've been really grateful to have this opportunity to sit down and talk with you, Amit. So thank you.
Thank you so much. Yeah, thanks for taking the time. And there's now I wanted to just, I think I wanted to bring back what you said, that I have such a strong resonance with, like this democratizing of the futures, and to maybe just completely, fully and wholly scrap this concept of nudging, like, which is like to me part of like a very, even though you do it with the best of intention, it's still manipulation. And instead just invite people along and do that cleverly, but explicitly, and be honest. Like, I think that's, so yeah, I want to just double click on that. And if people want to find you or take your master or however they would work or engage you in other contexts, where should they look?
I have a very public profile at kth.se. So if you Google Elina KTH, then you're going to find my profile, and you can send me an email. And there's lots of other things there where you can get hold of publications or see what courses I'm teaching and so on. So that's probably the easiest way.
Mm. Cool. The link will be clickable as well in the show notes. Wonders of technology. Thank you so much for taking the time. I really appreciate it.
Yeah. Have a great weekend.
You too.